We've dealt with this topic in the past from different angles, but I wanted to deal with it from a different angle, a very fundamental issue pertaining to the destruction of Sodom. You're all familiar with the basic story that the people of Sodom were extremely wicked, and Lot happened to live among them, and God decided to destroy them, and God sent the messengers to save Lot, and then God brought destruction, fiery destruction upon Sodom. That's the basic outline of the story. Now, there are a number of questions that I think we should address ourselves to. What's the most basic question of all? Exactly, we should try and understand that. What was their sin? What was the exact nature of the sin which was so terrible that they were deserving of total destruction? And we see that God is not quick, so to speak. I mean, God is, as we say, Erech HaPayim. God is slow to anger, and God always gives a chance. And you see, even with the destruction of some, God says, I'll go down. Ergon of the era. God uses human expressions, let me go down and see. And then, even at that point, God hadn't reached a final conclusion, so to speak, of course. And then God permits Abraham to state his case, all of which indicates that God is not quick. It's not God's desire to destroy the wicked, but rather to give the wicked an opportunity to live, to do tshuva. So therefore, when God does uproot an entire society, it must be a very serious kind of an evil. So we should like to know what exactly was the specific nature of their evil. It's not that clear. Okay. Another example, we see in the case of Yonah, that Nineveh was a sinful society, but God gave them a chance to repent, and they repented, and they were saved. So we should have a clear picture, if we can, as to what the nature of the sin was. That's the first question. The second thing I'd like to address is, well, before we get to that, I just want to make this point. Related to the first point. First of all, we'd like to know what exactly the sin was. But even if they were sinful to the extent that they warranted destruction, we have to ask ourselves the question, was that the policy? Did God go in and destroy every society that was deserving of destruction? Because if you read later on, it's clear that there were other societies at that time that were also very sinful, perhaps equally so. Perhaps Mitzrayim, Egypt, when Abraham went down, he couldn't even say that Sarah was his wife. They would have taken his wife from him, and they would have killed him. Moreover, later on, we've taken this up, the story of Shechem. You remember what happened? They abducted Dinah and Shechem. Raped Dina and so forth, and the brothers took revenge. You know, through the whole story, they worked out a ruse. I'm not going to go through the story again, but whatever the case is, they got them to agree to circumcise. They were all circumcised, and they were sort of joined together to become one nation. We discussed it last year, but they did it out of trickery. At least Shimon and Levi were involved in trickery, and then on the third day, when they were weak, they went in and they destroyed the whole city. So the question arises, what right do they have to kill these people? Because the only one that was really guilty of a crime was Shechem, but the rest of the city was basically innocent. So there's a whole discussion among the commentaries. The Rambam gives his answer, but the Ramban says that there's no need to find justifications. We see from the Torah later on that this was in the land of Canaan, that these societies had committed all kinds of abominations, because we'll have reference to it later on. It says later when the Torah warns the Jews about committing the transgressions, the sexual transgressions and so forth, it says, and the land shall not spit you out as it has spit out all the other nations, because they committed all types of abominations and so forth, and the land was filled with their abominations. which indicate that the societies that inhabited Canaan at that time were sinful societies, and they deserved to be destroyed. And yet we see that only Sodom, that God entered into the situation to destroy Sodom and Amorah, where they were not the only society. So the question arises, there's two questions. I mean, first of all, what was so special about their sin? And even if they did a sin which warranted, which meant that they were worthy of being destroyed, is that the policy of God to always go in and destroy a society? It would seem that there were other societies that also merited destruction, and yet they weren't destroyed. The question would be Jackie's question. Is there any significance to the manner of destruction? Because what happened was that God caused hail, and then brimstone, or, you know, a fiery type of hail to burn up the entire place. The Torah does describe the manner in which they were destroyed. And it was through some type of fiery hailstorm, which burnt everything, to the extent that nothing could ever grow again. Now, if there should be some significance, it should somehow fit into the picture, into the nature of the crime. Is there any significance as to the manner in which they were destroyed? I'd like to go through these brief references to the character of Sodom in the Torah. And then, of course, we're going to focus. The Torah does give us one account of the nature of the people of that city. It does give us one account in the encounter between the angels. The angels that come to visit Lot, and Lot takes them into his house, and then the entire city surrounds the house. So that seems to be something which is very important in terms of understanding what their fate was. Where are we first introduced to the city of Sodom and Amorah? Anybody? After Abraham leaves Mitzrayim. After he leaves Mitzrayim, so as we read in Bereishis, in chapter 13, 7, Pasuk 7, a dispute breaks out between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot. We're not going to get into the specifics of that, but they both had large flocks of sheep, and they got into a dispute as to where would be a proper place for them to let their animals graze. Then Avram says to Lot, "Let there not be any argument or fight between me and you, between my shepherds and yours, because we're brothers. The entire land is before us. Let us separate. If you go, choose where you want to go. If you go to the right, then I'll go to the left, and vice versa." Now, in Pasuk Yud, in 10, it says that Lot lifted up his eyes and he saw the entire plain by the Jordan. So the cities of Sodom and Amorah were located near the area of the Jordan. I think around the area, perhaps in the area of proximity to the Dead Sea, Yam HaMelech, I suppose. And it was Kikulo Mashke. It was very plush. It was very well watered. It was a very fertile kind of a land. As it says, before God destroyed Sodom and Amorah, it was like the garden of God, like the land of Egypt on the way to Tzoar. So the pasuk over here is indicating, it's interesting, it mentions before God destroyed. Because, so what's the connection? Of course, obviously, all this takes place before God destroyed. But what we're being told is that this land was extremely rich and fertile and plush and a beautiful land to settle in. Very, very high quality. It was like the garden of God. Couldn't have been better. Choice land. So it says that Lot chose the entire, that place to go to, the entire plain by the Jordan. And he traveled, and they separated. And then it says Avram lived in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled by the cities of the plain, and he pitched his tent up to Sodom. What's that? And then it indicates immediately, and the men of Sodom were ra'im v'chatayim, evil and sinful to God very much. That's the first indication that the people there were extremely sinful. The commentators point out that the reason why it's mentioning it at this point is to criticize Lot. That Lot was more preoccupied with the qualities of the land, and he wasn't that concerned about the character of the people. What does it mean? There's two expressions over here. So Rashi says that Royim, evil, begufam, with their bodies, They sinned with their bodies, physically. The chatayim v'mamona. These were the two elements of their, I guess, morally. That would be morally, would be with their bodies. I suppose it involved in all types of a lack of control over their instincts, sexual, all types of sexual abominations and so forth. And the other one would be with monetary. They had no respect for the rights of other people with regard to their money. Yeah. This is the first indication that there's something very sinful about this society. And it says Lashem to God. They were evil, apparently it could be evil and wicked, but not necessarily to God. Here it was to God. Now the next time we encounter a description of Sodom is in Parshas Vayera, when God reveals his plan to Abraham, and before Abraham pleads the case of Sodom. So it says, that's in chapter 18, verse 20, and God said, "The cry of Sodom and Amorah, because it is much, and their sin is very heavy." And the Ramban says the cry means the cry of the oppressed. So here the pasuk is indicating that the oppression and the sinfulness of the city has reached a tremendous proportion. Because that's another factor. I mean, every city has a certain amount of sin in it, and it's not meriting of destruction until that sin reaches a certain quantity. It has to reach a certain point, a certain extent. So it's very great. Now, let's take a look. We still do not know exactly, other than in very general terms, what the specific nature of the sin was, more specifically. Or the underlying corruption which permeated the city. Let's then study the episode that occurs. As you know, God had revealed the plan to Abraham via these three messengers. These three messengers were what you would call angels. They were messengers of God. They had come for a specific purpose, to inform Abraham. Then they departed from Abraham and they went to Sodom. The two of them went to Sodom. One was to carry out the mission to destroy the city, and the other one was to save Lot. Let's take up the story at that point, and let's analyze it very carefully. That's on chapter 19. Take a look at chapter 19. And the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gates of Sodom. And Lot saw them, and he ran to greet them. So this shows something positive about Lot, and Rashi points out that he had acquired this ability, this characteristic from Abraham, the midah of hospitality, chesed, to be decent to the stranger. And he bowed down, he bowed his face down to the ground. He bowed down, so he shows them, he runs to meet them, and he shows them respect. That's another element. So then he says, "Please, he refers to them as my master, please turn to the house of your servant and lodge there if you want them to stay overnight, and wash your feet, and then you'll get up early and you'll go to your way." So Lot appears to us to be very, very much like Abraham. Abraham is, in fact, when Abraham was sitting outside of his tent looking for people who were going by, he went out and he positioned himself deliberately to spot people in need of hospitality. And Lot also sat by the gates, and Lot went out to greet them, and he's very generous in his offer. He's very generous in his offer of hospitality. He's offering them not just to eat but to stay overnight, to lodge there. And they said, "No, we'll stay in the square." So at first they turned him down, but he implored them. He insisted, he implored them. He wouldn't take no for an answer. That's an amazing thing. Usually it's enough to just make such an offer, to be so generous. He was sincere. And after being turned down, okay, I did my thing, but no, he kept insisting. So they turned to him. They went with him. They saw that he was a righteous individual and he was doing it for the true purpose. And they came to his house and he made a party for them. That was nice. He made a party for them. And he baked matzah, and they ate. Now, before it was time to lie down and go to sleep, now the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, minar v'adzakein, from young to old, the entire city, mikatzel, from one end to the other, right? Mikatzel katzel, everybody surrounded the city, from one end to the other. And they called to Lot, and they said to him, where are these men that came to you this evening? Bring them out to us that we may know them. That we may know them. This seems to be an expression of what their evil was all about, what their corruption was. Then Lot is a great tzaddik. Lot comes out to them by the door. He opened the door, and he closed the door behind them. So he's putting himself at risk to save his guests. And he says, please, my brothers, do not do evil. So he realized that they had evil intentions with regard to these men. Well, I mean, we all know that the term veneda is a reference to sexuality, homosexuality in this case. And let us know them, which means that they would use them for sexual purposes. Well, it's the story. Then he says, well, you see that clearly he understood that their intention was for sexual purposes, because he makes a very strange, this is very strange also, which boggles the mind, because it's one thing to practice hospitality, but he says, behold, I have here two daughters who have not known a man, meaning I have two virgin daughters. Let me please bring them out to you and do with them what's good in your eyes. However, to these men, do not do anything, because they have come under the shelter of my roof. In other words, I'm not going to even attempt to explain this today. We've dealt with this before in different contexts, but on the surface, this would seem to be insane behavior, because knowing that you have to assume the person's operating within a certain framework. A person could be decent, he could be caring, but this seems to be self-destructive. To be so caring of others that you're willing to sacrifice your own daughters to a mob of strangers, that would be an insane person. But he wasn't insane. He had a rationale for what he was doing. We won't go into it. That's not our purpose today. Nevertheless, we do see from this that he was trying to appease them in a sexual way. So that clearly their demand to release the three men that we may know them was a demand that they be given up for sexual purposes. And they said to him, get out of the way. Move aside. And then they said, this one came to live here, and now he became a judge over us. He said he's a moralist. Now we'll deal worse with you than with them. In other words, they threatened him. Don't stand in our way. Who are you? You're not our moral authority. And then they put tremendous pressure on Lot, and they move forward to break down the door. And then the men, these are the angels, stretched out their hand, and they brought Lot back in. They saved Lot from the mob. They brought him back into the house, and they locked the door. And then the men who were outside the house were smitten with blindness from young to old, and they could not find the door. Okay, that's the end of the... from that point on, of course, now the angels inform him what they're going to do, and the story about the saving of Lot and his family begins. But this is the story, this is the description of the behavior, and it would seem to be that in this little episode we should be able to discover wherein lies the ultimate evil of the people of Sodom. Now, let's take a look at this pasuk. It says that there were three strangers in town, and all of a sudden the entire city comes out. And the wording there is very specific. What does it say? Yeah, kala amikata. The entire city poured forth from one end to the other. Now, what does Rashi explain? Rashi says kala amikata, the entire city from the end of the city. So he says mikseya yer amikata arakata, from one end to the other. She'ein echad mocha biyadam. Which means to say that everybody joined in. There was nobody that protested. What does that teach you? That's indicating something. Shafilu tzadik echad ein behem. That there was not even one righteous person. The entire aspect. So this pasuk is trying to explain to you the extent of the corruption. Because it's one thing. A city can engage in sinful behavior, but In any city that you can think of, you'll find some individuals that separate themselves, that they rebuke, that complain. It's hard to imagine in any society. There were even in Germany, there were heroes. The truth, that's the truth of the matter. I mean, you go to Yad Vashem, there were heroes throughout fascist Europe and in Nazi Germany. There were Germans that stood up, that protested, that gave up their lives, that protested and said, this is wrong. But here we see that the entire city was united, and this is to the point that there was nobody there that represented a voice of morality. And what do you see from the other thing? From young to old. From young to old. It also teaches you something. Yeah. Very important point. That there's one thing you may find in certain societies that they don't have high standards of morality, like in our society today. But still in all, they have the idea somehow of protecting the youth. That even parents who could be extremely liberal and free, or swingers, whatever you want, you know, engage in any kind of practices, but they have the idea that the children should be protected from this. That we're adults, that's the way we live, but children they want to protect. And you see, in fact, that's the whole storm of protest now in the city with these new curriculums. Right? That a lot of parents are up in arms because they decided this is wrong, and these types of things should be taught at home, and they don't want their children to be exposed to these kinds of teachings that they're, you know, about all the different kinds of sexual practices and so forth. Because it's not that these parents are necessarily so righteous or whatever, but they recognize that there's a certain innocence in children, and they don't want to have the children corrupted. A lot of people take that attitude. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's it. You know, I made my choices, but I want this child to have an opportunity. So that, what does that show? That shows that even though they're not engaging in the correct way of living, but still in all, it shows a certain respect, a certain recognition of the truth, of the ideal. The ideal has not been destroyed. You see, here it indicates two things, that they were so steeped in corruption that it was a natural thing to them. They had no desire to protect their children from this, and not only that, but they went together. Parent and child went together. That's a further breakdown, because it's very unusual. It's one thing, even if a parent allows their child, or the parent knows. A lot of parents will, we're not talking about the film world, we're talking about the at large, but even if their children are older and they're having relations, or even if they're living together, whatever, when you come to my house, I don't know, I don't care what you do. I'm not saying it's a correct attitude one way or the other, but not in my house. I don't want to see it, that type of thing. Which means there's a certain shame about it. It bothers me. I can't control it. I can't stop it if I have whatever. But that's not in my house. At least when you're in my house. Again, that shows that there's a certain element of shame. Or parents, when they do certain things, if they have certain kinds of parties, they'll make sure the kids are away. The kids are away for the weekend. Or unmarried, because today in our society, you have every possible scenario you can think of. A single parent. Right, a divorced woman or man, whatever, that has custody of the children, and they want to have their girlfriend over for the weekend, so they'll see to it the child should be away for that weekend, because they're ashamed to do that in front of the child. So that's a positive element in the sense that they, even though they're doing something which is wrong, but at least they retain a certain idea of shame. Now, as long as you retain a certain idea of shame, then there's hope, because it shows that you're not totally consumed by your animal passions. There's still a conflict going on, there's still a struggle, there's still an element of guilt. As long as the person is still feeling guilt, you never know, one morning he may wake up and think it over and make that change. But once it's parent and child are going together to do the act, that shows that all categories of shame have broken down, and that's total an animalistic society. See, apparently the word got out that there were three strangers in town. People found out about it, and that scene, that's another thing that's it. Again, if you read it, if you just try to look at it in a concrete kind of way, you know, let's say in our situation, three people come to town, this becomes the news. That's also strange. A lot of things are strange. Because, like you mentioned before, it's a little bit strange, even in a corrupt society, even if there was a large element that wants to engage in homosexuality, but here it says the entire city. It's so funny for three men. I mean, it's a... Yeah, and the word spreads. The entire city is there, from young to old. It seems if a group of people got a little crazy, got a little wild, and they want to take advantage of these people, So that you're not going to have the whole city there. You're not going to have all the children there. The KKK is a different type of thing because they, in their own framework, they did not regard what they're doing as wrong. They believe that they're fighting. That's what I'm trying to say. The fact, yeah, I'm saying that. But the fact of the matter is that since they have broken down all the barriers, since they have broken down all the barriers inhibiting, the sexual perversion and so forth, so therefore they raised their children on some kind of shelf. And the fact that they brought their children along with them, it showed that it reached the point. It didn't start out this way. It reached the point that in their minds it was okay. That's what I'm trying to say. You're right. But the KKK is a different kind of thing. The KKK is a different type of an evil. It's something, it's aggressiveness, but it's based upon a certain ideology. So they construct what the Nazis also. The Nazis indoctrinated. See, once the evil expressed itself in the form of an ideology, I don't think they had an ideology necessarily. This was a different type of a society. But in the case where it's an ideology, so then just the opposite, then it's a high ideal to be part of the Aryan race, and now of course the whole educational system is geared in that direction. Okay. Now, if that is, on the basis of what we just read, so why did they want destruction? What was the sin? Does this give you any kind of an insight into the deeper sin? Now, if we read the story on an obvious level, the way we described it, and the wording indicates, we made the Osam that we may know them, then it just seems to be a case of homosexuality. It just seems to be a case of homosexuality. What would strike me as strange, though, is that if that's the case, I mean, why was the entire city, from young to old, and that's a little bit funny, that everybody, from one end to the other, everybody was there. Tremendous, strange that you have such a situation like that. And they're not appeased at all. They're not appeased at all by his offer. There must have been some reason why he made the offer. It's not the craziest thing in the world, because they weren't just out for homosexuality, it seemed, because he would know that. If they were strictly homosexuals, which there's no indication they were, I assume that there was, let's say they were bisexuals, there must have been grounds he was making them an offer. What he was saying to them was, okay, I understand your situation, you're out for some sexual gratification, so I'll give you another alternative. I have two beautiful daughters that are virgins, take them, as opposed to the two men. And they refused, they wouldn't even listen to it. So what does that teach us? That they were so advanced in homosexuality, is that the point? And that's why they had to be destroyed? Or you're saying that they were the type of people that were so stubborn that once they said this is what they want, they wouldn't change their mind?
Stubborn,
because
I think it's more as much
of an egotistical. All right, well, that's so fine. So the stubbornness was rooted in the fact that they're egotistical, and I know what I want, and you're not going to tell me. But is that such a unusual or such a unthinkable kind of a sin that puts them in the category beyond the... I mean, a lot of people are like that.
Well, because they had already...
Let's say they would have accepted his offer. Let's imagine that. He always has to look for angles over here.
Right.
Let's say they would have accepted the offer of the two girls.
Right.
And let the men alone say, okay, it's not such a bad deal.
Right.
And they would have taken the two girls. Would that have made any difference? Would they have then been worthy of being... In other words, is this the crucial factor? Is this the test? Is the Torah pointing that out, that he made this offer and they rejected it because... Therein lies the element. The truth of the matter is that the offer of the girls and the refusal to take it is not just, the Torah is not just describing it because it happened to, but I think it does contribute to a deep understanding of the character of the evil over here.
Right.
Though I disagree with yours, the truth of the matter is, of course, it's not by accident that they chose these three men as opposed to his daughters. There was a reason why they wanted these three men, and it wasn't necessarily sexual. It has to do with the fact they were strangers, but there's one piece that's still missing from the puzzle. Now, if, as you say, Ronan, if their objective was to bring them down, because then they would have attacked Lot, because here Lot was not engaging in the same kind of behavior. So how could they tolerate a Lot? The essential point is, it was manifested through homosexuality, through rape, and so forth. But that wasn't the essence of the crime. It was rather to oppress the stranger. But what? It was just, was it just an expression? It was aggression. But this is what the Ramban said. I think you're going to find it very, very interesting. This is what I consider to be the new element, the new piece. And he says like this. On the, if you have a Ramban in English, you can check it out later. On Pasuk Hey, 19 Hey, that's 5, that we may know them. So the Ramban says the objective, the intention was here's the Hebrew, is L'chalos es haregel mibeinehem. What does that mean? L'chalos es haregel mibeinehem. To cease having all visitors come by. To discourage, to scare away visitors. To discourage any visitors from ever coming back to this place again. That explains why the whole city, you see, it was a policy over here. See, if it was just something that developed spontaneously, newcomers, let's say it's the other way, like some beautiful girls come into a town, you know, it's during spring break, wild guys from college, you know, so whoever hears about it may gather. But here you have a unified thing. It was a policy. It was an expression of a policy. And the expression, Acha Tichla, exactly. L'chalos, the whole point was, very good question. Ramban answered that. So, why? Listen to, let me just translate, as I said, this is from the Ramban, it's not my own idea. And he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, by the way. This is in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Tes, because they thought that because of the goodness, the wealth of the land, which was like the garden of God, that people are going to come there. They wanted to protect what they had. They didn't want any strangers over here. This was like a beautiful paradise. And they didn't want anybody coming. And they were mo'asei ha-tzedakah. They despised tzedakah. They despised charity. This is the essential chait. The essential chait was that they were in a state where they despised, not only didn't they perform charity, but they had a hatred for charity. They despised charity. But one second, let me just, what about Lot? We'll soon find out where it comes from. But what about Lot? But Lot was welcome, so Lot was welcome because he was very wealthy. It's different. You see, it was open. There were some people that could join the club. Those who didn't come there were spun. Those who came there, either two possibilities of it, either because of his wealth, so he wasn't going to take from them, or else out of kavod to Avraham, which means it was an honor to them, because Avraham was a well-known personality.
And he had
said, so because of tribute to Avraham, that wouldn't detract from their objective to keep this an exclusive club. But other than that, to allow people in, and then people are going to, they're going to be needy people, and there's going to be a need for welfare, we're going to have to share, they hated that. And He quotes from Yechezkel, which says that this was the sin of Sodom. And he said like this, Savata lechem v'shalva seshket, they became satiated. They were very prosperous and satiated with all the bounties that God had given to them. V'yad ani v'ed yon lo hechazika. But the hand of the poor, the impoverished individual, they didn't strengthen. They had no mercy for the poor. Amazing. This was the, in spite of what we read, all of the aggressive, it wasn't essentially the aggressiveness per se, nor was it the sexual deviation, because he says they were guilty of all these things. But what sealed their fate was the fact that they had no compassion towards the poor amongst them, and not only that, but they had an aggressiveness. They hated the idea of tzedakah. And what it says before, Roim v'chatam Hashem Ma'od, that they were extremely wicked and sinful to God, which means that they caused anger. They caused the anger of God, and they rebelled in their prosperity with the affliction of the poor.
That's what they were for.
No, they were poor.
They were poor himself?
Yep. That was the zaka, that was the cry. The cry of the oppressed. So what does that mean? What was the cause? One second. What caused this to come back? Something about before you. So the first thing we've established is that the incident that the Torah records, the main theme behind it is the homosexuality is just a means to an end. The objective was to discourage any type of visitors from coming. They didn't want to share. Now, what caused this? What brought them into the state? What brought them into the state was that they were corrupted by something. What corrupted them? The bountiful, the very goodness that God has given to them. That's the God, and that's why the Torah, see, now you're in context. Remember I said before, it says, like the garden of God, before God destroyed? Because there's a connection between the destruction and the extent of the lavishness. God had given them a very lavish situation. And this can be, now you learn an extremely important thing from this, that a very lavish situation and a tremendous abundance of all material things can be the most corrupting and destructive force in the world.
But this is exactly what comes before
Mandela. See, you have to realize that how it corrupts you is that it becomes an ego thing. See, because each person, see, that's, you take a look at like these Arab countries that have oil, totally closed societies, totally closed. They don't want anybody except for their own. I mean, there's no, they don't give a penny. In fact, you know, with Somalia, whatever, I think they're Muslim over there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But who has to come and rescue and save the United States? But what about their fellow Muslims, right? With the tons, they're sitting on tons and tons of money which they never even earned, just happens to be there. They wouldn't think they'd be giving a nickel. Because totally, totally corrupt, and they don't want any outsiders coming in. They even kicked out even their fellow. I mean, it's an amazing thing. The world doesn't even notice these things. That the whole pressure of mankind on Israel to give up a little strip of land for the sake of the Palestinians. But when Kuwait, or they expel a few, Israel expels a few troublemakers that are basically killers and want to destroy the whole site, that's a big tumult. But in Kuwait, they expel a few hundred thousand Palestinians, and nobody cares. That's their own brothers. That's their fellow brothers. He did like this. According, again, he's quoting the Gemara. He said they had every evil character trait. This wasn't the only thing. But their fate was sealed on that sin. Because, I mean, this should strike each person, by the way. Another benefit of this, of learning this, is that it should reinforce our idea about the importance of tzedakah. And we don't realize how important, and the failure to perform tzedakah properly is accounted as one of the worst sins. It's a very, very serious thing. He says, because they didn't strengthen the hand of the poor and the impoverished, the needy. Because they were constantly in that sin more than anything else. The worst sin of all, it's an amazing thing, the worst sin of all was how they treated the poor. Because that shows their egotism. That the wealth had gone to their head. Wealth can change a person. Because each person has a certain fantasy of being superior. Everybody has these fantasies of superiority, of egotism. Everybody wants to be the favorite, the chosen one. Now usually most people, they can't get away with it because reality doesn't cater to that emotion. You have to justify it. But when a person comes upon something, and excessive amounts of wealth, which puts them in a different class, then you see how he begins to treat. The very same person, you'll find it very often, the very same person, when he was just another guy making a living, you know, decent, friendly, this, that, suddenly he became exceedingly, well, now he looks down, he can't associate. Well, that's the whole point of the wealthy. The wealthy, I mean, can't associate, can't eat together with the helper. You know, this is the kitchen for the help. This is the idea of them sitting together and sharing of the same thing. There's a certain distance that a person, but this was even more so. This was to the point where there was an actual hatred of the poor. There was an actual hatred of the poor, and the idea that they should take anything that was destined for them.
Well, in Victorian times, they looked down on the poor.
Good point. In the Victorian time, they looked down on them, but that's a justification, it's a rationalization.
Right.
It wasn't their religious belief.
Charity would have only strengthened and reinforced.
Yeah, you're going against God's will, right.
Yeah.
He says they were constantly, in that sin, more than all of them. And he says, moreover, all of the nations, every nation, does a certain amount of charity with its friends, with its own people, and with its poor. So there was no, any nation you find, even a nation which is closed off, at least amongst themselves, they have self-help. So you'll have some nations that are very generous, like the United States is very generous, because they have, I mean, sometimes to a fault, I mean, successful with welfare and everything, but nevertheless, it's generosity. There's the recognition of the principle that we have to take care of the homeless, the helpless, and so on and so forth. but more so even with strangers. You see, the United States is relief to the starving countries and so forth. But then you have countries that, most of the other countries of the world, that wouldn't lift a finger for somebody else, but for themselves, for their own kind. So at least that's one level that shows a certain amount of compassion. But they were so corrupt that they did not disdain the hand of any poor. That was the extent of their corruption and their cruelty. Their loss, in other words, in their situation, their abundance of wealth had the effect that it removed any emotion of compassion from them. They were totally ego, and that means they were totally egocentric, and they had absolutely no regard for any poor person. That's what he says. That's why they were worthy of being destroyed. That's an amazing thing. Yeah. The next question comes up. So we've shown is that what the sin was. That they had committed a sin, which is terrible, and they were worthy of being destroyed. But if you remember at the beginning, those who were here at the very beginning, I pointed out that from the Ramban, that there were other societies that were also guilty, that had committed sins, and were worthy of being destroyed, yet God did not destroy them. So what necessitated? The fact that a given society may be worthy of destruction does not necessarily mean that God's going to intervene and destroy them. God should let them continue, and eventually there'll be, the other misfortunes will overcome them. I mean, there were great empires that, due to historical circumstances, they finally peter out. It doesn't mean to say that God is always going to intervene and wipe out an evil society. So all we've shown is that stone was evil, and they partook of a characteristic which warranted destruction, but why did God have to intervene? That's the question. That's basically what Jackie is asking in a different way. Do you understand the location? Where was Sodom and Amorah located? The part of Eretz Yisrael. This is part of Eretz Yisrael. And what he's saying is that God intervened and destroyed because of the high level of Eretz Yisrael, the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael. Now this idea is enunciated, the Rambam explains it in Vayikra. We read this on Mincha, in the afternoon on Yom Kippur, about the Arayos, the section about the forbidden sexual relations. And God warns us not to defile the land by engaging in all of these abominations. Ah, exactly. So now, it mentions that if you do so, if you sin in this way, by behaving like animalistic behavior, then you'll defile the land, and the land will vomit forth, vatuki, kiosk. The land, that's a new, it's a very interesting idea. It's in the character of the land that it vomits out all those who defile it. And that is why, for example, what is this, why were all the nations that existed before the Jews took over, why were they thrown out? Because it wasn't because the Jews needed the land and God just decided to throw them out and give the land to the Jews. Where's the justice in that? So the answer is, God told us to Avram that they would not return to the land until the sins of the people that lived there had reached the point where they were deserving of destruction. Now the Ramban elucidates, I can't go through the entire Ramban, perhaps in a different session. You want to go through it in Vayikra. Chapter Yudchas, 18, Pasuk 25. And a very, very important doctrine, which you really spend time, I don't have time today, just to go through all the elements of the doctrine, the special character of the relationship between God and Eretz Yisrael. What he's saying is that God is the God of Eretz Yisrael. That all of the other, that God set up forces of nature which control the destinies of all the other lands. But the land of Israel has a special relationship to God. As the prophet says, that God watches the land, so to speak, from the beginning of the year till the end of the year, which means that everything that happens in that land, since that land has been designated as the inheritance of God, it's tied up with the idea that the God is the God of the Jewish people, and the Eretz Yisrael has a designation as being the land of God. So because of that, I'll just quote the conclusion over here, but there's much more that we should go through. He said, the land which is the inheritance of God will spit forth anyone who defiles it and will not tolerate those who worship idols or those who engage in sexual abominations. And that's why even the Jews, see, the reason why is it that the that the Jews were driven with the exile. Why were we driven out of the land? It's the same principle, that this land has been designated for a certain purpose. It has to reflect a certain way of life, a certain type of holiness. And anybody who defiles the land will not tolerate anyone who defiles it. So it doesn't matter whether it be foreign nations or whether it be the Jews. When the Jews lived in the land and they became involved in the same types of idolatry and oppression and so forth, so the land spit them out as well. That's a principle which governs the whole existence of Eretz Yisrael. And that's why it says God warned us when he gave us these commandments that we should not. He said, because all of these abominations, the men of the land that were before you committed, and they defiled the land. So let not the land spit you out when you defile it, just as it spit forth the nations that were there before you. Which means to say that the same principle that determined the fate of those nations will determine your fate as well. So, on the basis of this principle, the Ramban explains, therefore Sodom and Amorah had to be destroyed, because A, the sin that they committed was one which was worthy of destruction. But where did they commit that sin? They committed that sin in the land which was the inheritance of God, which spits, vomits forth all of the people who defile it. But if that's the case, what about the other nations? The land spit them forth later, not at this particular point. Why did it have to happen at this particular point? So let me read to you. He says that the judgment which is executed against Sodom was because of the high degree, the distinction of Eretz Israel. Because that is part of the inheritance of God and will not tolerate people who practice abominations. And when the land vomited forth, the entire nation, because their egos were distorted. Because of what? Because of the tremendous goodness of the land. And that was a sign to the Jews. And God saw this, that this should be a sign for Israel later on, who was destined to inherit the land. And we read this, that's an interesting thing. If you read the Varim is filled with all of the warnings. Moshe warned the Jews about everything that would happen to them before they entered the land. They should not be corrupted by the land, because they were going to enter into a land which was filled with all kinds of wealth and benefits. Well, no. But the theme, if you go through the verse carefully, you'll see that this theme is repeated time and again. It says, guard yourself, lest you forget the Lord your God, and not keep the mitzvot and commandments that I command you. Then it says like this, lest you eat and be satiated, and build beautiful houses and dwell in them. And then your flocks, your animals will increase, and gold and silver, and everything will increase. V'rom levavecha, then your hearts will become haughty, and you'll forget the Lord your God, who took you out of Egypt. So again, there's a connection being made that when a person achieves a tremendous state of satiation, you find this in many people's lives. That when they're poor and struggling, then they're very religious. But once they become extremely successful, then they have no need. Later on it says, in the Shema, read in the Shema. What does it say? It says, V'achalta v'savata. You will eat and you'll be satiated. And then it says, Hisham v'lachem, guard yourself, penyichta l'vavchem, lest your heart deceive you. V'sarchem, and you'll turn away and worship other gods. So again, there's a connection between eating and satiation and worshiping other gods. And Rashi says, as soon as you're eating and you're satiated, then you better be careful that you should not rebel. Because a person does not rebel against God except in a state of satiation. A person does not rebel except in a state of satiation. And it says, lest you eat and be satisfied. You're also familiar with the verse, Vayishman Yeshurun wax fat, Vayivot, and kick. Which means to say again, that one of the main causes of corruption in an individual is the effect that the obtaining a situation of security and wealth and prosperity can have upon his ego. So the Ramban is saying that this is why God saw fit to destroy Saddam, because Saddam partook of that defect, that because of the good that God had given to them, this Gan Hashem, this garden of God, this had turned their hearts. This had made them into aggressive, egotistical people, lacking all compassion, and had led them to an extreme of sinfulness. Therefore, they had to be destroyed as a sign to the Jews, and that's expressed later on in the Devarim, when it says, "Gufris." What does it say? "Gufris v'melach reifa kalarza." Hail and firestorms burnt up the whole land. We asked that question before. Why was the land destroyed this way? Because it was measure for measure. Kamapechas stone. In other words, it says later on that when the Jews will sin and God will bring tremendous destruction upon them, then people will stare at it and it will be in amazement and a wonder. And they'll say that this is just like Saddam, the way God overturned Saddam, to the extent that everything was burned out. Ashehafach Hashem, that God destroyed in his anger. That is the reason why it was destroyed in this particular way. Because that was the cause. What brought them into this state of corruption was the fact that they were granted such a tremendous abundance of wealth. And he concludes by saying that there are amongst the nations evil and wicked people, and yet God did not do this to them. That's his question. We started out with that. This, apparently there were other nations. There were other nations that were equally sinful, and God did not do this to them. So why did God have to intervene and destroy them? He says that is because it is the distinction, because of the high level of this land. Because this is the Heichal Hashem. And he says he'll explain it further on in Vayikra. I just referred to it very briefly. So therefore, to conclude, I think we've answered all the questions. We've pinpointed what the exact nature of the evil was, as it's demonstrated in that particular story. And we showed the connection between the fact that it starts off being described as the garden of God, and why it was that God invoked this principle that the land will spit forth its inhabitants with regard to Sodom and Amorah earlier than with regard to the other nations. It's a sign to the Jewish people that when they will enter this wealthy and abundant land, they should not allow it to corrupt them in that way. I just wanted to add briefly one more point. This will also help us to understand why the story begins with the description of how Lot practiced hospitality. Lot was saved because he practiced hospitality. Now the theme of the story over here is the tremendous importance of the mitzvah of tzedakah and hospitality towards the weak and the needy. So you have two descriptions. You have the description of Lot, and also you have a very extensive description of how Avram practiced hospitality. And just quickly, I want to contrast the two very quickly. Take a look at the beginning of Ayera. And you see that Avram was communicating with God. He was sitting outside the tent. This is the beginning of Ayera, chapter 18. And he saw three men standing over him. And he saw them and he ran to greet them. And he bowed down to them. Very similar. You read the two accounts of the way Avram practiced hospitality and how Lot practiced hospitality. It seems to be extremely similar. Because he ran to greet them. And he said, "My master, if you please find favor in my eyes, please don't pass over your servant. Do not pass me by." He's begging them not to pass him by. "Let me take a little bit of water and wash your feet and take a rest under the tree." The same thing. He's offering them, "And then let me just take a piece of bread and you'll satisfy your heart. You'll eat a little bit and then you'll go. For this is why you passed by your servant." And they said, "Okay, we'll do what you said." Then it goes further. Then Avram runs to the tent and he grabs Sarah. Quickly, they bake three loaves of bread. knead the dough and make them into cakes. See, Renee, this probably was Erev Pesach. Just they were having cake. Right? Then it says that then Abraham, it says that then he ran to the flock and he took a young calf which was soft and good and he gave it to his servant and they hurried to make it. Then they took milk and cheese and milk and the animal that they had made. I guess they ate meat and milk together. Okay. And he gave it, and it says, "Who made Alayim? Tachas ate by Yochelu." And Abraham stood over them under the tree and they ate. That's the description of Abraham's practice of hospitality. We just read before at the beginning a description of Lot. Take a look at the description of Lot. Is there anything in the story which would indicate any type of difference between the two? Again, Lot implores them. Lot offers them lodging. They come to his house. Lot makes a party and bakes matzah. Pretty much seems to be the same. But I think there's one key difference. Yeah? Well, he said the same thing. You'll Avram says you'll eat and then you'll move on. There's nothing wrong with that.
It's not
that. Yeah, no, that's because he didn't want to delay them. No. Also, Rashi says because yeah. So that was positive. That wasn't negative. I would say like this: there is the key word. There's a number of differences. The key word over here is that it mentions party. Lot made a party. That Lot made a party. What does that show? That they both practiced hospitality, exactly. But the hospitality of Lot was rooted in a certain type of emotion that he had. It was a humanitarian emotion. It was a good emotion. But the emotion, to a certain extent, partakes of the desire to socialize, to have fun, to have a party. So it's true he was practicing hospitality, but at the same time he was gratifying his own emotions via a party. See, Abraham was a metaphysical personality. He was totally involved in communicating with God. His practice of chesed had nothing to do with the satisfaction of any personal emotion. It was purely on a totally different plane, purely for the sake of fulfilling the will of God. That's why it says, "Who omed aleihem?" He didn't partake. He served them. He did that. He was totally at their disposal. But the point was, just for the sake of the practice of chesed per se, not for the sake of gratifying any emotion. Anyway, I just wanted to bring it in context, to bring it in line with the story of the destruction of Saddam, which is, in contrast, a place which went to the other extreme, that they not only didn't practice hospitality, but what they were judged for was because they hated it. They hated it. So they were in such a state of corruption that they hated Saddam. And now we get paid.